a real conversation and some hard truths. Gangs, drugs, and guns. Giving a voice to those willing to sacrifice. We have stories that need to be told. We have lessons that need to be taught. Protect and serve. Welcome to The Quiet Professional. Hey everybody, welcome back. Nathan Rome is with you. Today we're going to be talking about some big picture ideas. They're going to be focused around transnational illicit drug markets. For that, I have Jason Ely on the program. I want to make sure I say in that right. It's Ely, correct?
Eli.
Eli. Okay. So Jason Ely here. Jason is a senior expert at the Global Initiative Against Transnational Organized Crime. Further to this, he's an illicit drug market and policy analyst who has researched, developed, and led technical cooperation and assistance initiatives addressing illicit drugs in African and Asian geographies. Jason's expertise focuses on understanding the contexts and characteristics influencing illicit drug use behaviors and the structural resilience of drug trade environments, particularly as these factors relate to the development and sustainability of harm. So I think we're going to have a really fruitful discussion here today. So welcome, Jason.
Oh, thank you very much.
You know, I kind of want to start on just talking a bit about you. You're with Global Initiative. I think when I see a lot of these organizations, a lot of people don't quite know what they do. There's a lot of them out there. But I want to know, like, how did you get to this point in your career and then involved with a program like Global Initiative? Because they're doing some really cool stuff. You guys put out a ton of information and reports.
Yeah.
So, yeah, tell us, how did you get involved in this world?
Well, I came to the Global Initiative after about a 16-year career working for the UN. And I was working in the drugs field for the UN Office on Drugs and Crime in mostly in East Asia, but also near the end of my career with them in Sub-Saharan Africa. And the whole aspect of drugs and a variety of different sides of drug markets and aspects around use and prevention and treatment and understanding why and how and where they move has been an element of the work that I've been doing for the duration of that time. And I just brought that to the Global Initiative and have been able to, I guess, be a bit freer and explore these issues in a wider geography around the world. So it's been really exciting.
Are you, would you consider yourself, is it like, are you an academic? Are you, I don't know, do you have like a specific title when you're in there?
Well, I wouldn't say I'm an academic. I'm a researcher, right? I mean, my job is senior expert, but I've always been someone who's been a bit suspicious of people who call themselves experts. Because yeah. I think the more I learn about what's going on in markets around the world, the more I realize what I just don't know or don't really understand. So it's kind of eye-opening to get this sort of view that what you think you know is not necessarily what's really going on in many instances. So I would say I'm more of a granular sort of enthusiast when it comes to communities and understanding and working with local communities to understand what was going on. I mean, ultimately, if you go back far enough, my background is in geography. Right, the study of the environment around us.
Okay. Do you, and what kind of made you focus on Asian and African geography? So how do you get involved in that? Is there any specific connection, I don't know, from a past life or something in the family? Like how do you get your trajectory in that direction?
Well, I was doing PhD research. So I graduated at university in Canada with my master's, and I went on to the UK to do a PhD, and the field work for my PhD was in East Asia. And I spent a lot of time over there. I moved over there and was really involved in trying to understand at the time developmental change on rural communities. And through the course of my work, ended up having or running into or being acquainted with a variety of UN officials. And unfortunately, my PhD didn't really work out for structural reasons at the institution I was at. But at the same time, an opportunity with the UN emerged. And, you know, sometimes in life, you reach those moments of opportunity where you have to make a decision that will change perhaps the rest of the course of your life. And that's what I did. I decided to abandon my PhD and join the UN.
Well, I mean, you're obviously doing some great things regardless, right? Yeah, I think I can only handle so much education. I did a Bachelor of Commerce, and that was more than enough for me. I was done with the school thing. No, but one of the things, and maybe we'll kind of jump on to the transnational topic. I watched one of your recent presentations, and this was from back in March of this year, and it was on the global synthetic drug markets. And throughout this presentation, I'll put up a link in the episode description so people can look at what I'm referring to and check out your research. But on this, you have this giant heat map of the world, and it's talking about the criminal influence in the different markets around the world. Yeah. Pretty much everybody looks like they're doing bad or it's getting worse, except for a few places in Central Africa and a couple spots in South America. I kind of drew my attention because I wonder what's going on there, right? So Canada and US, red or yellow on the map, like they're starting to get worse. But then you look at like Russia and China, and they're both also doing not so great. So this, to me, it kind of got me thinking on the politics side and the policy side. And it's like, well, you know, you have these traditionally conservative countries like China, like Russia, and you have more of these libertarian countries like the West, but nobody's doing things, I guess, in a great way. So I'm wondering, like, who's doing things right now, and why or how is it working? As I never expected Central Africa to be, you know, I don't know, are they fighting crime in a better way than we are, or do they just have different policies? So what's kind of the input there?
Yeah, so the map you're referring to is a mapping. So the study itself is something that we publish every 2 years. It's called the Global Organized Crime Index. And we've been collecting data around this for every one of the 193 states, countries recognized by the UN. So the idea behind it was that prior to this, there was really no global compilation of what's going on with criminal markets. And this goes beyond drugs.
Okay.
So we started in Africa. The very first one we did was for the 54 states in Africa. And that was in 2019. Then we moved it to cover the 193 countries of recognized by the UN in 2021. And the latest one was released in November last year for 2023. And what this piece of research does is that it measures the criminal impact of 15 criminal markets. So four of these criminal markets are drugs, heroin, cocaine, cannabis, and synthetics. But also it measures things like human trafficking, environmental crimes, and essentially all of the crime types that you can think of are transnational organized crime types. So, you know, burglary, robbery, things like that, murder, yeah, are not part of this. And it looks at the impact of those criminal markets individually in each of the countries. The other side of it is that it measures the capability of a country, something we call resilience, to respond to the criminal influences. You know, and these would be the countries that would have systems in place that can better respond to, say, the threats posed by drugs, or respond to things around the issue of trafficking in people.
So is that like the resiliency side then?
Yeah, that's the resiliency side. So one side is, how are these markets affecting these countries? And the other side is, how able are these countries to respond and to mitigate these threats? So we have 12 indicators on the resilience side. And so the map that you're referring to is a map of synthetic drugs around the world. And what that map shows, you're right, is a situation that if we look at the difference between 2021 and 2023, generally speaking, I think there were 100 countries around the world where their synthetic drug markets worsened. That means their score increased.
Yeah.
And that means the effect of the criminal drug market there became stronger, perhaps more pervasive. And that change can be from a very low value where previously there was a market, but it was very small and really had no impact to increasing. Or it could be at a very high level. The two countries in the world that had the highest scores for synthetic drugs, number one was Myanmar, and tied for number one was Syria. Myanmar, very high in meth, went from 9.5 to 10. So it was already an extraordinarily pervasive criminal influence in Myanmar that was related to that market. And it just went from 9.5 to 10. 10 is the highest score.
Okay.
And in Syria, it's the same way, but they have a different synthetic drug there. It's Captagon, which is largely amphetamine. So to the point of your question, those countries that didn't get worse. So there were a handful of countries that stayed the same. So there was really no change in those 2 years. And then there were, I think, 5 countries that the score went down. And there are a couple of reasons for that. It doesn't mean that the country was effective at responding to the drug market, to the synthetic drug market, necessarily. It could be that the perceived impact of the market in that country was seen to have lessened, or over the year, for a variety of reasons, or that it was thought that it was overstated to some degree in the previous survey. So the change that we're looking at is largely a change of about a half point or a maximum a point. So if we look at a country like Rwanda, which I think was one of 2 African countries that were colored in green on the map, it doesn't mean that the synthetic drug market is not harmful in that area.
Okay.
It just means that the level of its influence has lessened. And I think compared to its neighbors, that's probably an accurate score. Why is it lessened? The survey doesn't go into that. But I think if we looked at some of the other indicators, some of the resilience indicators, you might find that there were some modest changes there that led to that result.
Okay.
But really, is anybody effectively responding to synthetic drugs? No.
Yeah.
No, globally, the answer.
Yeah. Like, so when I look at these kind of maps, I always like to get the meaning behind it, right? Because you could easily take this out of context and be like, we should all be like that country. It's like, well, this is very, like, we're talking about a very specific topic. So when you're looking at the overall picture of the world, we're talking about government policies. There's no one in particular, whether it's in the West or anywhere else in the world, no policies that anybody has that seem to be effective in combating any of this, because I'll come back and ask that again, but you also, there was another report I was looking up where it was from the UN Commission of Narcotic Drugs. And it was just talking about like agreement on policies. And I mean, I think it was kind of status quo for what people expect in the world. America and Europe were kind of on one side and there was Russia on the other, and it was kind of evenly divided, 62 countries on the side with the West, 40 countries were with Russia. And this is kind of the traditional conservative and liberal divide as well. But, you know, when you look at these maps, everybody's having a hell of a time combating the synthetic drugs. So is there any kind of ideology or policy or anything that does work out there? Or you see maybe that lends more to the resiliency side then?
Yeah.
Not on the front end?
Well, there is a correlation there are a few correlations that can be made in the data, but one of the correlations that can be made is that those countries that have higher resilience scores, so a higher ability to respond to the impacts of criminal markets, are countries that are democratic in their orientation.
Okay.
Contrasted with those countries that are deemed to be authoritarian. So in that sense, I mean, you could say that countries that are judged to be more democratic, and it's not us who judge the nature of a country. It comes from a survey, and I can't remember the name of it right now. I think it's the Global Survey of Democracy or something, and I think it's out by UN body. I feel really bad not remembering that, but
it'll be a long name. It probably has 15 words,
but it's in the report. So if anybody accesses the report, they'll see it.
Yeah.
You can make that correlation that the freer a democracy is, you know, the freer a country is from the point of view of being more democratic, the higher its resilience score is mapped. And I think that just comes down to a lot of the elements of how we measure resilience as well, in terms of things like international cooperation, efficacy of institutions, and a variety of other things like that. But beyond that, I mean, you mentioned the CND, the Commission on Narcotic Drugs. The most recent meeting was in March of this year. And so the CND is the global body of states that oversees what they call the world drug problem and the global response to it. And their view this year, although there are a lot of contrasting views to it, was that the world is making progress in responding to the harms of illicit drugs.
Is that on the front end, though, like before it becomes a problem or gets worse? Or is that on the resiliency side?
No, they don't. Well, resilience is something that we measure, and it's not something that's recognized by the UN or anything like that. Their concern is the three international drug treaties and compliance by the 193 member states with the terms of those three drug treaties. So their position has always been and will continue to be one of prohibition, one that drugs are prohibited, a particular list of substances are prohibited, and countries should enforce that prohibition, and they should enforce it in ways that adhere to the global strategy that the CND has developed. And they're very familiar ways, right? You should arrest people who possess. You should imprison people. You should not allow the use of these substances in your state. You should schedule them in your country and things like that. And I would ask, I mean, there are lots of views around whether or not it's working, but I think if we look at the last 100 years of drug prohibition or attempts to prohibit drugs, we haven't really seen any sort of disruption. That the international drug market has continued to grow year on year. The number of people using has continued to grow year on year. And the pervasivity of substances, meaning the number of countries in which you're now finding these markets, has continued to grow year on year.
Yeah.
There are more countries in the world now with synthetic drug markets than there are with heroin markets, which is weird.
Yeah.
In a way.
You know, I think when it comes to like the outright prohibition, it doesn't work in the sense of keeping out of maybe people's hands, because organized crime, they'll always find a way. They always adapt. They'll get around whatever rules. So whether it's fully legalized, they'll own that system, or if it's completely prohibited, they become the only supplier for it. I think the prohibition side is more for when we're talking about like morals and what we're instilling in kids. And it's just to say like, hey, as a society or community or however, you know, whatever the scale is, we don't agree with this. Like, we don't think you should take these things. Because now I think about like the legalization of cannabis and just seeing like from a policing perspective, when I'm out on the street, like everybody's got weed everywhere. So it became okay to do that. And people don't see any harms or any effects or think there's any effects of it. When there are like real consequences, even for something as basic or simple, I guess, I'll use those words, or cannabis. But when you talk about like harder drugs, I think people are kind of, they get desensitized to it. They think it's okay. So that's just kind of my perspective of where I think maybe that prohibition side kind of comes in. It's more on like the morals and the values and the ethics on that. Kind of when we talk about like the countries cooperating when it comes to policies and how they're going to fight this problem, one of the interesting things was talking about definitions of different words. And I was reading this in this same report from the Commission on Narcotic Drugs, definitions differing depending on who uses them. So like harm reduction, like I guess, you know, China might say harm reduction, we might say harm reduction, but they mean two totally different things. You know, is there, how much cooperation is there or can there be when we can't even agree on like the basic definitions and premise of, you know, what we're trying to do here? So we get like a clear divide in all the countries, and then we can't even agree on like definitions. So how do these countries work together and actually fight this problem? One of the words coming up was gender, which I kind of figured that would be a thing. We see it on our passports. You can put gender X, and then you can't get into half the countries in the world. So just how do they work together? Is there zero cooperation, or do they just kind of agree on one or two things? Like what does it look like at that global scale?
I mean, you raise a good point. And I think when we talk about cooperation, we need to talk about two things. You've got bilateral cooperation, so between two states, and then you have multilateral cooperation. And I think the role of the UN is very important as a venue for trying to encourage a more consensus-driven understanding of things like the term harm reduction. So you mentioned in the document that there were competing views on it, and that's exactly how the meeting played out in this past March, in that a resolution was proposed using the term harm reduction, and there were a number of countries that were questioning what it really meant in terms of application, because in some countries, there is strong opposition to needle syringe programs, for example, or opioid substitution programs, treatment programs. And they don't see that as falling under their definition or their view of what would be harm reduction. And they would rather use other terms. So harm reduction in itself has a very basic meaning, you know, that to reduce the harms caused by the use of substances. And it also has a very political side to it as well. And it's the politics around drugs as a whole, but responses to drugs that I think are what's creating a challenge when it comes to working with some countries on aspects of trying to address the harms of drug use more directly, because quite frankly, people are going to use drugs whether or not you give them a clean needle syringe. But the value of a clean needle syringe is that you're reducing the potential for the transmission of bloodborne viruses.
Yeah.
And you've got to weigh what you think are the better, what are the better results for society as a whole, right? And try and get beyond the morality that tends to seep into this. But when we talk about cooperation in the wider sense of how do we better respond to supply reduction or things like that, You still have similar challenges with other words, right? When you start talking about jurisdiction, territorial boundaries, the role of particular institutions, who's responsible for responding to social services aspects of dealing with this? Who's responsible for sharing information between states? Which department is it? Which ministry? Which agency? Who shares? What kind of information is shared? How do we define that? How do we agree with that? And that's a challenge multilaterally, but also a challenge bilaterally between two countries. So what might be agreed, say, between Canada and the US, mm-hmm. in terms of tracking and sharing intelligence around that, would be perhaps quite different between what's agreed between Canada and China, for example, for the same task. So it's just one of those things that adds to the wide list of variables out there that continue to influence the ability of countries to respond, and in some ways the efficacy of their responses in that regard.
You know, and kind of on that, I'm wondering, maybe we'll bring the war crime element into this. Are we seeing, you know, in your travels and talking about policy, are we seeing any governments that are more lenient? Because I know a lot of people accuse China of not stopping precursors from flowing out and different chemicals. How complicit is government in a lot of these things? Do you have any kind of insight into that? Like, is someone not trying as hard as they could, essentially?
I think we have to accept that, I mean, as much as we have 193 countries around the world, we've probably got 193 or more different views on drugs and on the role that particular agencies or countries need to play in that response. So you raise the example of China and precursors. The Chinese, yes, China has been and to some degree continues to be, not China the state, China the country, and in particular the chemical and pharmaceutical industries there, are the source, the origin point of a lot of precursors that are being shipped to North America, as well as finished products that contribute to an expansion of synthetic drug supplies. But here's the challenge. A lot of the precursors that are being used or sourced from China have dual purposes, right?
Yes.
Majority of them are not scheduled, so they're not restricted. And the majority of them are used in the production of other industrial processes. Right? They have legal purposes. And so when it comes to trying to enforce that, trying to control that, the Chinese government's argument has been, how can we restrict legal free trade of these particular goods? When that's going to have an economic impact on us and these organizations, and when the problem is not that they're being supplied, but rather that somewhere down the line they're being diverted and used in other countries by other actors for illicit purposes. Okay, I see that, but from an enforcement point of view, I mean, it's not dissimilar to the challenges that are occurring in places like Canada or the many countries of Africa, where these precursors are coming in under the guise of fueling development. And in a lot of these underdeveloped countries around the world, you really want to support developmental processes that are going to lead to a better economy, provide jobs, make the country better off. But how do you encourage that on the one hand, but yet try and respond to this growth in synthetic drug production on the other? That I think is part of the challenge of policing in that way. You mentioned, are states involved? Well, yeah. You couldn't have a global drug industry if you didn't have corruption in state institutions, complicity by workers in state national institutions. It's not to say that the institutions themselves are promoting the drug trade, but it's to say that corruption is a feature of the global economy, and it's through corruption that criminal markets are enabled to prosper and expand. So really, does that mean that countries themselves or governments themselves are corrupt and involved in the drug trade? That's true in some circumstances. But by and large, it's more the role that individuals within institutions are playing or not playing in trying to be better at surveilling and interdicting in the trade, and they're simply not doing it.
Well, I think maybe I would word it like people are the problem. So it's not necessarily the system or the ideology or something. Like, you know, there's issues with each one of those. But again, that kind of like you're saying, we could have 190 countries, we have 190 opinions and ways to fight it, and not everybody's agreeing. But at the end of the day, it's the individuals in there that you have to deal with. Kind of on this same topic, where does Canada fall in the globalization of like the synthetic drugs? I've heard we are becoming a net exporter of things. You know, how would you describe Canada's role when it comes to the illicit drug market? What role do we play in that? Are we net exporters? And, you know, what aren't we doing that we should be doing?
Well, I mean, certainly Canada is a destination market for a lot of the substances we're talking about, synthetics in particular. But in recent years, I would say in the last, say, year and a half, Canada has really started to take over, particularly on the West Coast, BC, and to some smaller degree, border areas with Alberta, a role of production alongside the role of transit. So the Port of Vancouver is a significant transshipment point for drugs.
Yeah,
either transiting, coming into the country and moving through the port somewhere else, or for substances like fentanyl and methamphetamine that are now being produced in labs in Canada and then being moved out of the port. The value of Vancouver Port and the value of BC in particular are twofold. One, BC is very close to the northwestern U.S., which is a very large market, Washington, Oregon, large market for fentanyl. And to a lesser degree, meth. So it's a part of the country that is more easily supplied from Vancouver, from BC to the Northwest, than it is from Mexico up through the US into the Northwest. So that's one aspect of it. The other aspect is its proximity to Australia, New Zealand, and Indo-Pacific trade. So the port has obviously very strong connections to that part of the world. And the best place you want to ship your meth, if you're going to ship it anywhere in the world, is to Australia, because the price per gram in Australia is among the highest in the world. Mm-hmm. And your return is going to be significant.
We saw this in Kim Boland. She highlighted some of this in her recent work out there.
Yeah, it's that's the attractive nature. So if you're an organized criminal group who specializes in making and moving drugs, meth in particular, you're going to want to ship it through Vancouver to these places, because, of course, Canada is often viewed as a safe country, right? A country of origin that's safe. So if your cargo shipment originates in Vancouver, they're going to look at it differently than they would if it originated somewhere in Mexico or Central or South America. From a point of view of trying to filter the traffic that comes in, because, of course, in ports around the world, we only have the capacity at most to inspect 2-3% of containers.
Yeah.
So you've got to find a way to cut down the number. If you're seeing 10,000 containers a day at your port, how do you cut that number down to the ones that you really should pay attention to? And it's a process that continues to evolve and is hard. But so where does Canada stand? I think we're not nearly at the point of being in the area of concern from a criminalization influence perspective nationally, we're still in the bottom half of the overall categories. But from the point of view of resilience, we're quite good. We've got a resilience score that's higher than the US. We've got systems in place that I think are enabling us to at least have the capability of responding better to some of the harms related to this. And you might argue that that is why our overall criminality score is lower than what it could be, given some of the things that are going on.
Kind of on the distribution side, was watching, I think it was your very last presentation that you were doing. You were talking a bit about the internet and just kind of the role that this plays and where some of these transactions actually take place, all the deals and conversations. Can you kind of explain the role of the dark web and how these conversations actually happen out there? Like, how do you go and connect and then say, hey, I want to trade, you know, 100 tons of meth or whatever it is, and you're going to send me all this money. Can you kind of explain, like, how do these groups kind of connect and meet up and where this occurs?
Well, it's not just the dark web was always this kind of black hole that we thought of for years, right? This place that really bad people went to for nasty pornography and a whole variety of other things. But my reference was more to the technological advancements that continue to occur around internet-based communication and other mm-hmm. technological features. So what we've seen in and continue to see, particularly as a result of COVID and the lockdowns that accompanied COVID, is that in many markets, especially markets that are in countries that suffered long-term lockdowns, the retail trade of drugs, so the lowest level, your street distributors, in many countries move towards using social media apps or using internet applications. Yeah. And it could be something as basic as WhatsApp or Facebook Messenger, things like that, to connect with their clients and organize ways of purchase that got around the traditional face-to-face retail transaction. And that is something that has continued following COVID to be a feature of the market that is being adopted by more and more distributors and to some degree, more and more users, particularly in countries like Canada, right, where you have a mobile phone, you've got really great internet service everywhere, and your ability to use apps is largely unrestricted from your telecommunications provider, unlike other countries where there are some serious controls. So there's that level of communication that is occurring and distribution that is occurring. And in some countries, Ukraine is an example. We recently published a report on how the drug trade has evolved in Ukraine following the Russian invasion. Mm-hmm. And one of the features there that is also common in other countries is dead drops. So you have distributors that are taking orders and payments online and then providing locations of dead drops for users and others to go and pick up their drugs. So there's zero connection offline between users and dealers. And being a law enforcement professional yourself, you know that that has an advantage for both sides in terms of being detected, right? It creates yeah. a much lower profile for you and keeps you with this sense of security in terms of the transaction. But if we go beyond that, the shift from cash to online currencies has also been a significant move, making it easier to take payments, to move payments around, and to really do business as a whole. in the early days, one of the hardest parts about being a drug dealer was, how do you deal with the hundreds of kilos of cash that you're storing in your building or whatever? Stories of, you know, transports moving down into Mexico filled with cash, and how to get that physical cash into the legal system. And it's becoming a lot easier now through the use of different online currencies and other online financial instruments to move your cash around and to clean it, to move it into purchasing things online, and finding ways of parking your money that hide its illicit origin. And so that's becoming one of the areas of greatest growth, but also one of the areas of challenge for law enforcement when you start looking at trying to address what I think is one of the streams of illicit markets, which is the commerce around it, as a way of trying to disrupt the market as a whole, is chasing the money and trying to find a way around that.
Yeah, it's certainly a struggle for law enforcement. Like we really lack the resources to go after those real big players in that sense. I also just don't think, at least I haven't seen, there's been no convictions. I don't even think there's been any real big charge files on the money laundering side, kind of going right back to the Cullen Commission and just talking about some of the issues around that. One of the things, just as we're kind of coming up to the end of our time, I want to ask about was just the technology. This is also something that you talk about, is technology in identifying some of these synthetic drugs. So what are these technologies? If you could kind of describe them for the listeners, but also who uses them, and you know, does like every market have access to them, you know, depending on, you know, countries and stuff, do they all have access to this, or is it, you know, something that's maybe too expensive? So how do we detect these things? What are the type of technologies being used?
Well, what I think you're referring to, at least in the sense of Canada, would be something like drug checking services. So one of the, the greatest health challenge for Canada's illicit drug supply is contamination.
Okay.
You've heard the phrase out of BC in particular that it's a poison drug supply. And one of the reasons for that is that most of the substances that you're going to buy on the street today, whether it's ecstasy or cocaine or whatever it is that you want, most of them are either not going to be that substance at all, or they're going to be contaminated with a variety of other substances.
Yeah.
So if we talk about fentanyl, yes, fentanyl is a challenge in that it's being found in other things where it shouldn't be, cocaine, for example. But there are a lot of people who use fentanyl in Canada as their primary drug of use. And one of the challenges with that is that fentanyl itself is adulterated by substances like nitazenes, which are xylazenes, which are substances that have a variety of other uses that are not fit for human use, but are used to string out the high of fentanyl.
Okay.
And the problem with them is that they don't respond to the overdose medication that a lot of first responders carry or other people carry to try and reverse an overdose.
Like the naloxone. Yeah.
And they're not going to come back. So services have been set up where some very basic tests are available to determine whether the drugs that you have are contaminated or not with different substances. It's a challenge because, of course, possession is still illegal. And drug users are a population of people who use drugs are a population that doesn't have a great experience interacting with formal aspects of societal governance, like law enforcement, or the medical community. But in some communities, and I'm thinking of some communities in BC in particular, but also here in Ontario, they do have a health service that provides free checking of substances, pill checking, and other things on a voluntary basis for people to see what's in their drugs. And they use basic scientific instruments. They could use test strips, for example, which is very basic, but something called a spectrometer, where they can get an indication of what it is and whether it is what it says it is, to something much more involved, which is a machine called a GCMS, gas chromatography, mass spectrometry.
Okay. Yeah. This is why I leave it to the experts to explain, because I wouldn't be able to say.
So there are very basic to very advanced levels of trying to determine what's in the supply. And the reason you want to know what's in the supply is you want to know if users are going to use.
Yeah.
We have to keep that at the fundamental core of what we're doing. People who use drugs will continue to use, the majority of them. And therefore, if you want to reduce deaths, you want to reduce other harms like transmission of bloodborne viruses and other things, you want to contribute to an improvement in overall community health, including the health of people who use drugs, mm-hmm. then you need to include services that help them identify what is in the substances that they're taking.
What I was kind of thinking on that too is like, if we have better technologies, and I guess it's affordable, we can better define the problem. So we know, like you're saying, we know what we're dealing with. And if you go to, like, I don't know, if you go to a poorer country and they don't have the technologies available, then they have no clue what they're dealing with. They just think, oh, it's a bad batch of cocaine. But really, it's laced or stepped on with all kinds of stuff. Like, who knows what they're putting in there? So if you don't know what you're fighting against, how do you fight it? So that's kind of what I was thinking around the whole
technology. Or it's not even cocaine.
Yeah, it's not even cocaine. But, so
I mean, we've tested cocaine that's turned out to be ketamine, mm-hmm. or methcathinone, or a variety of other synthetic substances sold as cocaine. And if you're a law enforcement officer and you're presented with a white powder, right, you have no idea what that is. Mm-hmm. And in the absence of having the ability to test something, and I would say when we're talking about street level testing, you want something that is reasonably accurate and reasonably fast, not too big, right? Easy to handle and easy to use.
Yeah.
And you're right. There's really no perfect instrument out there yet that can do this. Although there are companies that are trying to sell magic wands to law enforcement bodies and others as the solution. I mean, it's capitalism, right?
Yeah. Yeah. 100%.
But we're not there yet.
So just as at the end of our time, I want to give you a chance to say kind of, you know, what are you working on next? Any big projects coming out?
Yeah, we're doing a few things. We're in the process right now of mapping the supply chain of cocaine from origin to user in a number of different regions, so Europe, Africa in particular, and looking at the value chain, you know, the price changes as it goes through, looking at the different organizations involved in that. So that's one feature. I mean, the focus of our work tends to be granular in nature, right? We're focused on understanding what is happening and why is it happening in these places. So when it comes to drugs, the primary questions that we always ask are what drugs are available here? How are they being used? Where are they coming from? Where are they going? That kind of thing. And no country is in the position, including Canada, to be able to say they know exactly what's going on in their drug market at any given time.
Yeah.
It's just not possible to know that. Often our information is provided by seizures. We see something and we think, oh, okay, we've got this problem. When in fact, the absence of seizures is not absence of potential substances in the market. So we've got the cocaine routing thing. we're going to be starting some work in Myanmar, looking at the market there, because Myanmar finished top of our organized crime index, which is not a good place to be. They were also third from bottom on the resilience index. So not only were they the most criminalized, affected country in the world, they were also the country that was third least able to respond to that criminality.
Okay.
So in two aspects of that. And we have some work starting here in Canada, looking at the 401 highway, which is in the Ontario portion anyways, that connects Southern Ontario to Montreal, and looking at it through the lens of it being a significant trafficking corridor.
You know, maybe real quick, if I can ask on that too, just when you're doing some of this research, do you get, like, I get you can talk to police and get different stats, or do you get any of the criminals, the bad guys? Do any of them ever offer up any info? Like, do you actually have ways to source that?
Yeah, in every drug report that I've written anyways, and that some colleagues have done, all of which are available on our website, we go through the methodology that we use. And in every case, I've been fortunate enough to be able to interview people from the grassroots of the market, your street dealer and user, up to importers, major importers and members of organized criminal groups.
Interesting.
And I think it's that, I mean, it's a challenge. And a lot of that is down to levels of trust that have been built between myself, the organization that I have, and the communities. Because, you know, it's important to protect your sources. And it's important to the wider community that we understand what's going on. And so, yeah, we do speak to these people, and we do get insights that otherwise law enforcement can't, or is not in a really good position to try and do.
Well, for understandable reasons, sometimes they won't talk to us. But, you know, actually, when I've had people on, like Kim Bolin, I've had a few journalists on, you know, they have their sources, and I can understand why people might tell them something or a certain version of it, at least might hear a different thing. And I mean, well, for us on our end, that's our job to corroborate things and make sure it's accurate. But yeah, no, I find everything that you're doing super fascinating. So I'm excited to have you on here today. Last thing, if you could let people know how to find your work, how to follow you, any social media websites. So where can they get in touch?
Well, you can get any of our work for free at globalinitiative.net. We've got, I think last year we produced close to 100 reports. We've been around for 10 years now. And we look at all aspects of criminality. So we look at all criminal markets. We're not just focused on drugs. I just happen to run the drug programming side of things. I'm not on any social media anymore except LinkedIn. Social media, I think when you're working in the drugs field, created a lot of challenges to life. And I just want to have to put up with those challenges any longer.
So, yeah, I agree.
On LinkedIn, but otherwise they can, I mean, I'm happy to talk to people directly. They can reach me through the website.
Great. I'll remind everybody to follow, like, share, leave some comments for both the Quiet Professional and Global Initiative. So, you know, thank you very much for coming on the show today. I think it was very insightful conversation. So I hope people take a lot away from this. So yeah, appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Nathan. It was a pleasure.